you are standing and confessing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is Loretta Ross, one of the nation's leading scholars and activists in the movement for reproductive justice. She was the co-founder and national coordinator of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective from 2005 to 2012, a network founded in 1997 by women of color, specifically to organize women of color in the reproductive justice movement. Ross was the founder and executive director of the National Center for Human Rights Education in Atlanta. Before that, she was the program and research director at the Center for Democratic Renewal National Anti-Klan Network, where she led projects researching hate groups and working against all forms of bigotry. She launched the Women of Color program for the National Organization for Women in the 1980s and was one of the first African-American women to direct a rape crisis center in the 1970s, launching her career by pioneering work on violence against women. She is the author or co-author of several books, including her two latest, Reproductive Justice: An Introduction, which she co-authored with Ricky Solinger, and Radical Reproductive Justice: Foundations, Theory, Practices, and Critique. Today I'm going to talk to Loretta about the meaning of reproductive justice and how it seeks to expand the traditional concept of reproductive freedom beyond the mere issues of abortion access or the typical pro-choice, pro-life divide. My conversation with Loretta Ross in just a second after this week's commentary. Well, I am incredibly excited about the conversation I'm going to have today on the program with Loretta Ross. Have known her since the early 1990s, actually. Met her at a time that I was doing anti-David Duke, anti-white supremacist work in Louisiana in 1990 and 91. And she had been involved with the Center for Democratic Renewal out of Atlanta. Going to have her on today to talk about some of the work she's been doing most recently around reproductive justice and how that differs from the issue of reproductive freedom and pro-choice rights on the issue of abortion, and how that all connects to race, too, because there's a definite connection there. One of the things that I've always found interesting in this debate on reproductive freedom or reproductive justice is that when you look at the history of the way that women's reproduction has been controlled, often by the state and certainly by white male patriarchal power historically, it's been an interesting sort of trajectory, and particularly with regards to black women and women of color, but with regard to white women as well. Let's think about, of course, historically, you know, that the goal for slave owners, people who enslaved other human beings, was to have those they enslaved, the women, be as fertile as possible, have as many children as possible, because the more children they had, the more that added to the wealth of the slave owner, which is one of the, you know, motivations behind so much of the rape that took place on the plantation. There was a desire to create new wealth by breeding that wealth, right? But of course, as enslavement comes to an end, then you begin to see things flip. And now the interest of white supremacy and the interest of the state becomes very different. Rather than wanting to breed more black people because that adds to the wealth of a handful of rich white people, the goal is to limit black reproduction. And so you begin to see the introduction of eugenics and sterilization programs. They weren't only used, I should point out, against black folks and people of color, indigenous women in particular. They were also used against white women who were seen as quote unquote imbeciles or had low IQ. There were cases, famous cases, Carrie Buck and others, where the courts said that white folks should be sterilized so as not to pass down another generation of imbeciles or whatnot. But for the most part, this was a disproportionately racist policy, as well as obviously a misogynistic one. Between the early 1900s and the early 1970s, there were literally tens of thousands, by some estimates as many as 100,000, black and indigenous women in particular, who were sterilized involuntarily by agents of the state all around this country, not only in the South, all around the United States. And in the early years of the 20th century, that was something that was very much supported by some of the leading intellectual minds in the country. The reason I wanted to bring that up in the context of my conversation with Loretta today is that now that we're in this sort of moment where the debates around population control and reproduction are generally seen as being about abortion, right? We tend to have this debate where the right wing wants to get rid of abortion and in some cases even birth control. And so the right wing is sort of in favor of all this baby making, you know, having as many babies as you can and not trying to stop it because God wants you to have as many children as you can bear and all this stuff. And then those of us on the left are seen as, you know, believing that women ought to be able to control those things for themselves. The reason that's fascinating to me in terms of what I want to talk about today is that there is sort of a mixed mind about this among the right. So like on the one hand, you have people on the right who are making an issue of the supposed genocide of black babies in their mother's wombs, because they'll make the argument that Planned Parenthood targets black communities and black women and is deliberately going in to abort black babies, which of course is absurd on multiple levels. And she'll talk about why. You know, the thing that's always stuck out to me about that is it sort of gives the impression that women, black women, don't have agency, right? That black women don't have the intelligence or the strength to withstand the cajoling of the nurse or the doctor at Planned Parenthood. Like somehow if Planned Parenthood just goes out on the street in a black neighborhood and says, hey, you want to abort your baby? A black woman who otherwise was planning on having it'll be like, yeah, why the hell not? I mean, it's, you know, it's Thursday and I'd sort of like to go out tonight. So yeah, I'd like to get rid of this thing. Like nobody does that. This idea that black women are not exercising choice, that they don't have the capacity to rationally choose when and if to bear a child is really fundamentally racist, and in this case, racist and sexist. And so I think in that regard, obviously the argument's absurd, but the right makes that argument. But at the same time that they talk about the supposedly authoritarian fascist attempt to control black reproduction by forcing abortion on black women, they're also the very same people that when the issue of racism comes up, want to talk about how the quote unquote real problem isn't racism, it's not discrimination, it's not unequal opportunity, but rather, they say, it is out of wedlock childbearing. In other words, these black women are just having too many babies. So it's an interesting contradiction, right? On the one hand, they're saying that we don't want to limit how many babies black women have by offering them abortion or birth control or whatever. But on the other hand, then when black women do have babies, they get blamed for the problem of crime in the community. They get blamed for the problems of poverty in the community because they're having all these babies, quote unquote, out of wedlock. And so they're really both irresponsible on the one hand because they're having abortions and irresponsible when they're having babies that they ostensibly can't support. So they sort of put black women in this catch-22 where nothing they do can be right. And what I want to talk about today, I don't want to talk about the abortion piece in my commentary because I will talk to Loretta about that, but I did want to talk about this out of wedlock childbirth piece because this is the thing that you always hear right-wingers say. Whenever you bring up the issue of racism, they want to talk about all the quote-unquote illegitimate babies that black women are ostensibly having and how that really is what explains the problem. Because when you have a child that you can't support, you're more likely to be poor. When you have a child, you're trying to raise it on your own, you're more likely to be poor. That child's more likely to get in trouble because ostensibly they don't have a male role model, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. First, let me just point out, there's been some interesting studies on this. Looking at the data, black men who are the fathers of children where they're not married to the mom, so they are fathers of children being raised by a single parent, that those dads are actually just as likely to be involved in their children's lives on a regular basis, a day-to-day basis, than white fathers in two-parent homes. So yeah, the couple may not be married, the father may not be in that house every night, but that is not the same as being uninvolved in their lives, in the lives of their children. They're actually just as likely to be involved. So number one, that's a huge myth. The idea that these children are being raised with no men around is just not true. There's both emotional support and financial support that this research suggests Black men do provide. But beyond even that, the bigger problem with this narrative is that the entire argument about Black out-of-wedlock childbirth rates is completely wrong. This is one of the most commonly believed myths. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you'll hear Black folks repeat it, right? You will hear Black folks who will say, yeah, we just need to stop having all these babies out of wedlock, blah, blah, blah. And yet the data says that this is all bullshit. So let's go through it, because this is a really good example of how data gets misused, misconstrued, misinterpreted, and how our social innumeracy, if you will, which is just to say sort of our illiteracy at understanding numbers, what they do and don't mean, gets us in trouble. So the data you will normally hear thrown around is that about 70%, 71% of babies born in the Black community today are born out of wedlock. And then they will follow that up with the argument that back in 1970, it was only 37.5%, which is to say that the out-of-wedlock child percentage has doubled. The share of babies born in the Black community who are born out of wedlock has almost doubled since 1970. All of that is true. Okay, now set that to the side for a second. The problem with that is that argument, that data does not prove what right-wingers think that it proves. They are using that data as a way to suggest that Black women and their male partners, and really the larger Black culture from which they come, are increasingly, you know, behaviorally pathological, that they're engaged in irresponsible sexual activity, and that's the problem. What they fail to understand is the difference between the out-of-wedlock birth share and the out-of-wedlock birth rate, but those are not the same thing. And the only one that really matters in terms of telling you anything about the behavioral norms of Black single people is the birth rate, not the birth share. Okay, so let me just sort of break this down for you. So if you look at the data from the Centers for Disease Control from 1970 to 2013, you will find 1970, 37.5% of all babies born in the Black community were born out of wedlock. By 2013, that number was 71. It was actually down from 72 in 2011 or 2010. The thing is, that very same table that shows you that data, which is available from the CDC website, also shows very clearly that the birth rate for unmarried Black women has fallen by more than a third since 1970. Now, you might say, well, how is that possible? How can the birth rate drop if the percentage of babies that are born out of wedlock in the Black community almost doubled? Real simple. The birth share and the birth rate are not the same. The birth rate refers to a very specific thing: the number of live births per 1,000 women between the ages of 15 and 44, which is prime childbearing years. So you determine the birth rate by looking at that. How many babies are being born for every 1,000 women between the ages of 15 and 44? And for unmarried Black women, that number fell. It was 95.5 births for every 1,000 Black women unmarried between the ages of 15 and 44 in 1970. By 2013, that number had dropped down to 61.7 births for every 1,000 such women. So that was a massive decline. It was especially significant for teenagers. You look at data from the National Center for Health Statistics, and what you see is that birth rates for teens have dropped in every racial group, but especially Black teens. From 91 to 2013, the Black teen birth rate dropped by 63%, almost a two-thirds decline. It is now at an all-time low since we've been keeping records on that. Let me repeat, the teenage birth rate for Black teenagers is at an all-time low right now. Not an all-time high, an all-time low. So whether we're looking at teenagers or adults, the teen data from the National Center for Health Statistics, the overall data from the CDC, unmarried Black women are already doing what conservatives would tell them to do, namely having fewer children while they are unmarried. That means that even if you agree with the idea that having a baby out of wedlock is some inherently pathological, horrible thing, and I mean, that to me is an arguable proposition, which I don't have time to get into here, but even if you accept the conservative worldview that you just ought not have babies out of wedlock, the fact is, if that is meant to be a critique of Black culture must be getting healthier and less pathological rather than more so, because they're already going in the right direction using the conservative definition of what the right direction would be. So let's get back to that 71% figure, because that's still out there and they still want to make a big deal out of that. The reason that the share of births that are out of wedlock in the Black community has increased from 37.5 to 71% is because, although births to black unmarried women have fallen, as I said, considerably in that time by over a third. Married black couples have cut their birth rates back even further, right? So if you have married black couples that are having far fewer children than before, you know, back in the day, they might have had 7 or 8 kids. I remember going to school with kids in elementary school and black kids who were, they had moms and dad in the home, and they also had like 7 kids. There was one friend of mine had, I think he was the youngest of 12 or something. That was relatively common back in the day. It isn't common anymore. So if married black couples are having a lot fewer kids than before, and in fact, the numbers suggest that for black married couples, birth rates are down by half to two-thirds. If they're cutting back at an even faster pace than single women, then of course the overall percentage of births in the black community that are out of wedlock is going to go up, but that has nothing to do with the supposedly irresponsible behaviors of single black women, right? Essentially, what's happening is fertility rates, both for single black women and black families in the United States, are following the same trends that you can see in any country in the world. Basically, as individuals make gains in educational access or economic well-being, they tend to cut back on childbearing. That is true in every country, in every culture, and it's happening in the United States, which means, ironically, if you really, you know, want black single women to have even fewer children, I suppose the best way to do it is make sure they can all get a college education and guaranteed health care and have good jobs, and you won't have to worry about it. But you notice the right never suggests that. There's one more thing they don't suggest, and here's the big one. Because here's my modest proposal, right? This is the way to test whether conservatives really give a shit about out-of-wedlock birth rates in the black community. If conservatives are so worried about that, if they're so convinced that the share of out-of-wedlock births in the black community is a terrible, horrible social indicator, and if, as I already showed you, single black women are already cutting back on such births at a record pace, where it's pretty much impossible for them to cut back at any faster pace than they are right now, then there's really only one other way to bring down that 71% number. You know what it is? The right wing needs to start a campaign right now to encourage black married couples to have tons of children like they used to in the old days, right? Because obviously, if married black couples started having a lot more children, say 5, 6, 7, 10, 15, 20 kids, that's the way to bring that 71% figure down. If you want the percentage of kids born in the black community who are out of wedlock to plummet, you can't do much on the single mom side because they're already cutting back, like I said, by more than a third, teenagers by two-thirds. But you could bring that 71% figure down by having black couples have tons of children, go all Duggar family, right? Maybe we could start subsidizing fertility drugs for black families, right? So they can have triplets and quads and quints, right? That way the share of out-of-wedlock births in the black community as a share of the overall births in the black community would plummet, and everybody on the right wing could stop talking about shit they do not understand. Of course, they're never going to propose this. And do you know why they're not going to propose it? Because you encourage black families to have tons of kids, and now the black population in the United States is going to go up dramatically. And you know what? They don't want that. They don't want more kids to be born into two-parent families in the black community. They don't really want more black children. They don't want larger black families. They just want to use the idea of social and cultural pathology to batter black people. You think they want the percentage of the national population that's black to go from 12.7, which is what it is roughly right now, to like 14 or 15, at the same time that the Latinx population is increasing and is going to be probably 19 or 20% within a couple of years? You got to be kidding. Bottom line, right? These critiques of black culture that rely on tropes about out-of-wedlock childbearing are false, and they are racist. They perpetuate stereotypes of hypersexuality that are at the root of white supremacy and always have been, and they're based on lies. It is obvious by now that the right will stop at nothing to deflect attention from issues of structural racism or police violence in black communities, unequal opportunities, unequal resources, persistent racial gaps in every measure of well-being. But rather than address all that, they will retreat, as they do with this out-of-wedlock childbirth smear, to victim blaming and black culture shaming and reality challenged slanders against African-American people. And until we start calling them out for their bullshit clearly and unapologetically and exposing their statistical fraud and manipulation, until we do that, the movement for justice can't hope to prevail. I'll be back in just a minute. My conversation with Loretta Ross coming up. Well, Loretta, thank you so much for joining me. I have to say, first of all, this won't mean a lot to the listeners, but I think it's a funny story. I think the last time that I actually saw you was in 2005. I was teaching over the summer at Smith in the School of Social Work. And we, because we share a speakers bureau, Speak Out, they were having a retreat or a board of advisory meeting or something in Boston or in Cambridge. And we were there, and my kids were, my wife and children were with me. And we came into Boston, made a couple days out of it. I went to the meetings, and I remember very distinctly my youngest child, our youngest daughter, who would have been not even, I think she had just turned 2 years old, saw you. And you had this beautiful skirt on, and she saw you, and she came up to you, and she looked at me, and she said, "Is that a princess?" I don't know if you remember this.
No, I don't. Well, this is wonderful.
Rachel looked at you and said, "Is she a princess?" And you looked at her and said, "Yes, I am. Yes, I most certainly am a princess."
First of all, yes, I am a princess, but your daughter probably thought that because I always wear African garb. Part of my armor is to look as ethnic as possible.
Right.
And so your daughter saw me in my armor and took it to be princess or queenly garb. So tell her thank you for me.
Yeah, she didn't need all that. She didn't need all that Cinderella shit. She had Loretta Ross. So she was ahead of the game. Right.
Exactly. But you peeped my whole card that whenever you see me, I'm uber ethnic because most of the time you see me, I'm dealing with teaching white folks like you do how to recognize white supremacy, how to challenge it, how to divest it from all of ourselves, because we all live in the same toxic sea. It's just that some of us swallow more of the water than others.
Yeah. So much to talk about, both with regard to sort of just the state of the country in general, when it comes certainly to issues of race, but also very much with regard to the issues that you have been writing about and active around for so very long. I know in the last year, you and Ricky Solinger have released this fantastic book that I'm looking forward to reading the full book. I've read excerpts of it, Reproductive Justice, an Introduction. And I want to really spend some time on that, because it seems to me that when we talk about issues of women's reproductive freedom and abortion access and the full range of women's reproductive health, the assumption sometimes, even on the so-called left or among progressive people, is that we assume we're all talking about the same thing. But there really is a difference, isn't there, between the way that some folks talk about these issues and the way that other people do. And it seems to me that divide is often rooted in issues of race and class. So talk a little bit about that, if you could, historically, the way these things are framed and why those framings can sometimes be problematic, and why you have chosen to talk about this as an issue of reproductive justice, as opposed to, let's say, reproductive choice, reproductive freedom, some of the terms that other people use. What are the differences and why do they matter?
In 1994, Hillary Clinton was leading a healthcare reform campaign on behalf of her husband. And somehow the Democratic Party as a whole thought that if they omitted mentioning reproductive health care from health care reform, they could somehow slide it past the Republicans.
Yeah.
Well, how well do you think that worked?
It did not, clearly.
But we black women, 12 of us black women, were in Chicago hearing about this plan. And we had our WTF moment, like, excuse me, reproductive health care is the main driver of any woman to a doctor. So if you're going to omit reproductive health care, you're basically offering us a male-centered health care plan you want us women to support. That wasn't going to fly for us 12 black women. So we decided to form a coalition, put an ad in the Washington Post to say no, and we coined the term reproductive justice in that moment by splicing together reproductive rights, which basically focuses on abortion rights, but saying, no, we need social justice too, because it's social justice issues that help women determine if they're ready to become a parent or not. And so we spliced together reproductive rights and social justice and coined reproductive justice, not only to serve as an ad for that Washington Post ad in 1994, but it served to spark a whole new way of organizing among women of color, because we said it's about abortion, but it's beyond abortion. It's about health care and living wages and environmental justice and the school to prison pipeline and Black Lives Matter. It's about a whole lot more. And once we started organizing our movement of women of color using this new framework, what we discovered was that the more radical wing of the white women's movement was attracted to our framework because they had also been very frustrated by the paralysis of the pro-life, pro-choice debate, only focusing on abortion and ignoring all the other issues that women and families have to deal with. And so without us intending it, reproductive justice took on a life of its own, eventually started eclipsing discussions around pro-choice, pro-life, because there were people who were both on both sides who could understand and resonate with the fact that all pregnancies should be wanted. And if a woman has a planned pregnancy, but she doesn't have health care, if she doesn't have job security, if she's experiencing violence, that planned wanted pregnancy may become an unwanted pregnancy. And then maybe an unplanned pregnancy where the person just got caught by surprise, but then did an assessment and say, okay, I'm ready. This is my time. I've got health care. We won't be financially stressed. My other children are okay. I'm going to turn this unplanned pregnancy into a wanted pregnancy. That's kind of how people actually make those decisions. And so the politics of trying to just start with the pregnancy never made sense to us because you got to go upstream and look what's happening in people's lives as these pregnancies come along. And that's what reproductive justice calls attention to. Because it came from African-American women, we define white supremacy and neoliberalism as the largest threats to people being able to make autonomous reproductive decisions, because those are the things that threaten the right to have a child, the right not to have a child, and the right to parent your children in safe and healthy environments, which is the core definition of reproductive justice.
Well, I think that's so powerful because, you know, we do get stuck in these dichotomies of pro-choice and anti-choice, or what they want to call themselves, pro-life. But like you said, there are folks on the side that are frankly restrictionist, if not abolitionist, when it comes to abortion, and they are not on the side that most of us on the left certainly consider our side. And yet there are people within that camp who could be very open to the idea that women have to have the kinds of choices that allow them to make decisions about when to have children, and when they do choose to have children, have those children healthy and in a position to actually raise them. And obviously one of the things about that that's so important is that it really allows us to I think, on a political level, not to be cynical or think about it only in that way, but I think it allows us to tell who are the people on that anti-abortion, anti-choice, whatever term we use, side, who are really just about controlling women in an obvious patriarchal, misogynistic way, and those who actually give a damn about women's health and women's freedom. Because we need to know who's who, right? I mean, there are people on that side who are clearly have no interest in empowering women at all. And then there are those who talk as if they do, but yet they're still on this highly reactionary tip currently. And I think with the reproductive justice frame, you allow us to sort of break that dichotomy a bit. How have you found that framing to have affected the larger discourse? First, let's say, with regard to some of the traditional white-dominated liberal reproductive choice organizations, and then how has it played, or has it really had any impact on some of the anti-choice abortion restrictionist folks, in your estimation?
I think it's impacted people on both sides of the discourse. As I said, we've become the gravitational node for, I think, the reproductive health rights and justice movement, because more and more people are using it and sometimes trying to even co-opt our frame on the left. So I think we've had a decided impact on that. On the right, I think we've also provided a talking point. Is you read my latest book, Radical Reproductive Justice, I actually have several essays in there by people who self-define as pro-lifers using the reproductive justice framework. And so they have defined for themselves the common ground that they see with those of us who are supporting abortion rights, but at the same time, supporting more broadly women's human rights. And so I think we've made some inroads there.
I remember back in the early 90s, even a few years before that healthcare debate that you mentioned, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton having led in many ways. I remember I was living in New Orleans and I was doing work against David Duke when he was running for the Senate and for governor. And in addition to that, though, one of the other things I was doing, because as is so often the case when we do, you know, nonprofit work, you know, you have a job one minute, the next minute the contract runs out, you get another contract, you sort of bounce around, and I certainly was. And so in addition to the anti-Duke work, I was also doing some organizing with a student sort of reproductive justice, although they weren't using that terminology, organization out of New York that had some local organizers in New Orleans, and I was one of them. And as I was trying to blend these two things, because at that time, Louisiana, of course, there were several reactionary anti-abortion bills that were in front of the legislature, and David Duke had a very reactionary bill at the same time that I was that we were fighting in the anti-Duke organization, but that I could not, for the life of myself and my co-organizer, Annalise Singh, a wonderful organizer who I was working with on that at the time, we were trying to get Louisiana Choice, which was the NARAL affiliate, to take on this bill that David Duke had introduced, which was a bill to essentially sterilize women who were on public assistance, right? It was a NORPLANT insert bill that was going to essentially bribe poor women, disproportionately of color, disproportionately black, to take NORPLANT contraceptive inserts and essentially for whatever period, 3 to 5 years, however long those last, sterilize themselves as a condition of receiving public assistance. And to us, this was obviously part of this larger attempt to control women's reproduction, in this case, to limit black reproduction. And we tried to get these quote-unquote mainstream, mostly white-led pro-choice organizations to care about that. And it was like you were speaking a foreign language at the time. They just couldn't get their head around that that was also a choice issue. The choice of women not only to end pregnancies when they're not ready to become mothers, but to have children when they are. And they just couldn't get their head around that.
Well, that's why I think many of those same women have gravitated towards reproductive justice, because we fight equally hard for women to have the children that they want to have and to raise them. Yeah. So I think you were in a dilemma, and we had not yet created that intersectional framework to answer that dilemma. So it wasn't available to us. What was available at the time was the concept of intersectionality. But the larger pro-choice movement is slow to the mark in understanding that, because I had the same battle in Mississippi when Mississippi was trying to pass a personhood amendment in 2011. And they were also putting on the ballot an anti-voting amendment, a voter disenfranchisement amendment. And I could not convince the majority of the pro-choice movement how much it was in their interest to fight against restricting voting rights as it was to fight against the personhood amendment. They just couldn't make that connection, or chose not to. As I've always wondered, after a certain point, it's the choices that you make, not the information you don't have. And fortunately, I think that Mississippi vote was a turning corner for the pro-choice movement in many ways, because they have not made that same type of mistake since then, failing to intersect issues when the leadership of women of color demands that they do. Yeah. That might have been the other missing piece in 90 and 91. And was there a leadership body of women of color in New Orleans at that time who could have made that connection and built that bridge? I'm happy to report New Orleans has great women of color-led organizations working on these issues, Women with a Vision, Women Health Justice Initiative. And so they've got a lot in place now that simply wasn't in place in 91. I mean, Sister Song, my own organization, was organized in 1997, because we needed to fulfill a need to have national voices for women of color working at these intersections. And we sparked a lot of organizing in places where it didn't exist before.
I think it's really important that you mention that, because sometimes, you know, those of us who were in the trenches doing various types of organizing and social justice work, and we don't see sometimes the, you know, the ultimate victories that we want to see, and that's why we keep fighting. But when you talk about, as you just did, the way that, let's say, since 97 or since 94, this debate has shifted, the framing has shifted, the coalitions are changing and building, it does sort of, I think it's important to know that history, because it makes you realize that more progress is perhaps being made than we like to believe. Just the issue of intersectionality, which in terms of that terminology, Kim Crenshaw really sort of creates in the late 80s. And now that is the term that is on everyone's lips. And granted, that doesn't mean we're all using it the same way. And sometimes when a term gets real popularized, you know, you never know how folks are using it. But I think we have to acknowledge that something's happening when the theoretical frameworks are moving and shifting so quickly. So does that give you a certain degree of hopefulness that maybe things are moving in the right direction, and that progressive and left folks are maybe getting our shit together in ways that aren't always visible to us?
Well, first of all, Tim, I have to say always where I'm coming from, what grounds me. Obviously, I'm a Black Southern woman from rural Texas. My mother cleaned white folks' houses on her hands and knees while raising 8 kids. And so when you ask me, her daughter, are things getting better, I'm asking you, what planet are you living on that I'm sitting in this chair having this conversation with a white person about white supremacy in a way that would have gotten my mother either fired or worse?
Right.
Only privilege allows you to see history as starting with yourself. That things are getting better, I think, is inevitable. Our ability to interpret the historical moment that we're in may or may not be sharpened. I don't know. Yeah. But I think one of the things that I celebrate post-November 2016 that a lot of other people mourn in many ways is Trump's election. Because while it was disappointing, it was not totally surprising to those of us who keep our eyes on the netherworld. And the most significant outcome, as far as my work goes, is that he drove a Mack truck into white solidarity. Because before, you know, there was the organized white supremacist movement, and then there were all of their silent enablers who couldn't be bestirred to challenge this thing that was marching, and that people of color and LGBT folks and people like you who are woke have been calling attention to, like we're Chicken Littles all around the world. And the fact that he woke up a significant portion of the white population to the danger of white supremacy, even to the point of mainstream media finally being able to wrap their lips around that phrase, is a gift that keeps on giving. And so instead of us mourning about the overt nature of white supremacy electorally, we should be celebrating that we have something palpable and visible with which to organize against. Because before, it only affected people of color in an obvious way.
No, I think that's a really key point. I've been starting off all of my talks for the last, probably since the election of Donald Trump, with this sort of, I sort of joke about it, that I feel like we got to find the silver lining in the storm cloud. And maybe the silver lining is that, you know, for the last 8 years when Obama was in office, we had to basically convince white people that racism was still real, because it was like, but, you know, we've got this Black president. And so the silver lining is we don't have to hold white people's hand anymore either. If they don't see it now, right, they're never going to see it. Now, the danger, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it, one is obviously that in the midst of the overtness of white supremacy under the Trump administration, obviously a lot of people are getting harmed by this. And so there is a downside to the upside. My other fear, sometimes I worry that when the white supremacy is that overt, it gives an out to nice white liberals who can look at it and go, oh my God, isn't that terrible? And then distance themselves from it. That's sort of what we did in Louisiana. A lot of white folks, when David Duke was running, it was like, you know, oh, David Duke, he's a horrible Nazi. But, you know, they still had the same retrograde views about welfare recipients and about immigrants. So do you worry that some of the white folks who were certainly not overt white supremacists might actually be demobilized, at least in the sense of understanding their own involvement, and sort of make it like the good white people over here versus the bad white people over there? Does that concern you at all?
Well, that's always been going on, though, You know, Dr. Willie Parker says it best. He said, you know, at times like these, you've got to remember it's always been times like these.
Right. Yeah.
So
the shit is not new. Right.
Yeah. The sad part is that our opponents are scarcely original, and I fear that we aren't either. And so we really need to say that part of the cultural dissonance that happens as we explain white supremacy is that we sometimes do a bad job explaining it. People see it as a moral attack on their character as opposed to an analysis of an ideology or a body of ideas. They don't see how we can constructively divorce or divest ourselves of it because we tend to make it so personal as opposed to the political project that it is. Part of the reason that I teach my appropriate whiteness class is that if we start from a standpoint of making white folks feel ashamed of being white, we have nowhere to go from that because right. They're not going to successfully not be white. And so I learned this back when I was monitoring hate groups when we first met, that the only people who were talking about white pride and appropriate and whiteness were the white supremacists. And I said, well, what about all the other white folks who do not identify with white supremacy, right. who are now being guilt-tripped into being white? What is our response for them?
Yeah.
And so I think it's very possible to teach about white supremacy to white folks. You're going to encounter that denial, that guilt, that abhorrence, that desire to separate. I mean, that is just par for the course. That's usual. That's predictable. And like any other educator, when you encounter those things, you come up with a strategy to teach through them and help them self-identify these things for themselves. And perhaps even most importantly, for the families at the Thanksgiving table that you'll never get a chance to reach.
Absolutely. Well, on that issue of white supremacy, it's a very tricky ideology, and it has all kinds of ways of weaving itself into people's narratives and understanding of issues, including the issue of reproductive justice. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, because it's been so pernicious and also so common in the last several years, is the way in which some of the folks who would roll back women's reproductive freedoms, justice, access to various forms of reproductive health care have couched particularly their anti-abortion narrative in the politics of racial ecumenism and equity. The folks who were out there saying, you know, abortion is genocide against black people. And it's a very cynical use of racial justice terminology and concepts. And these, of course, are reactionary people usually doing this who have never really demonstrated a significant amount of concern for actual genocide against black and brown bodies, but they're using it in this case. Could you talk a little bit about where that comes from, what it's really about, and how do folks arm themselves against the manipulation of those really legitimate concerns that black communities have about the way that they have been used and they have been experimented on and they have been manipulated? How do we arm ourselves against the use of that for ends that are really quite in line with white supremacy in so many ways, as well as misogyny and patriarchy?
We had to deal with this in 2010 when these billboards first went up around Atlanta, basically saying that black children are an endangered species. I wrote about it in my latest book. And what that basically was saying is that black women are committing genocide against the black race, they claim, because we were choosing to exercise reproductive control. Now, that's not an original thought. That is something Marcus Garvey said in the 1920s. He didn't say it quite as rudely, but he thought that we should overbreed ourselves as a response to white supremacy. So that's not an original thought by any means. But this billboard attack was very unusual. What it turned out is that black surrogates had been used by the white anti-abortion movement to create this myth that black women were being coerced into having abortions because of the race of the child. Now, the myth fell apart when we pointed out that you could never find a black woman who was choosing an abortion because she was surprised that her child was going to be black. So we wondered whether we were the real targets of this advertising campaign, or was it designed to make white people feel guilty about supporting abortion, right, for fear of being defined as racist if they do. It really was a very well thought out manipulative message that you could not read on its surface because it just did not make sense on its surface. But it also accompanied bills in state legislatures that empowered or even required doctors to inquire about the motives of women seeking abortion, mainly women of color seeking abortion, because white women were never asked, are you having an abortion because of the race or the gender of the child? Right. It was always directed towards African-American or Asian-American women, this accusation that we could have been having abortions because of the race or the gender of the child. So it set doctors up to, for the first time, question a woman's motive for seeking a service. And that was very unusual because heretofore, doctors' questions were restricted to medical ones. You know, when was your last menstrual period? Not, why are you having this service? And so they were trying to write into law a requirement that doctors get into women's motives. We don't think it was, again, to help there be more Black or Asian babies in America. It was to write into law the obligation of doctors to serve as judges on women's motives for seeking abortions, which, of course, would have then been amplified and expanded to affect white women, because there are some people who say you shouldn't have an abortion just to continue your education. You shouldn't have an abortion just to not be poor. You know, you'll figure out a way. You shouldn't have an abortion if you've been raped. You'll figure it out. I mean, there are all kinds of people who make judgments about women having abortions. And so they were trying to use Black people as a way to write into being a regulation that would then allow them to better control white women.
And I think your point is really well taken, that that whole idea of, you know, the most dangerous place for a Black child is in its mother's womb, that was clearly aimed at white people. I mean, that was aimed at the emotional nerve center of white people to get them, I think, to believe that by being against abortion, you're actually taking a stance for racial
justice.
Yes, for racial justice. So it helps to assuage some of that guilt. It allows some white liberals, hope in their mind, to be peeled off.
For racists to declare themselves civil rights champions.
Right, right.
Because the sponsors of all of this legislation are the people in Congress who have opposed every civil rights act that's come across their desk.
Well, one of the things that you wrote about recently, you had an essay about a week ago, maybe is when I saw it, a few days ago, talking about the importance of Planned Parenthood's next head, because Cecile Richards is stepping down, the importance of having a woman of color in that position. And talk about why that's important, because I thought you made a really great argument as to why, from a purely strategic argument, about why this is so important at this moment in time for Planned Parenthood to do that. So talk a little bit about that.
First of all, as I said in the article, Planned Parenthood's economic structure depends on the women in the most need of public health services coming into those clinics. And because of capitalism in our country, the women in the most need are brown and Latina. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones that Planned Parenthood's economic structure depends on. So I thought that a president representing those communities, in touch with the needs of those communities, could bolster Planned Parenthood's financial structure with a lens of lived experience that I think would be invaluable. The second reason is because they're up against this white supremacist plot to control the reproduction of white women, but at the same time, Black and brown women become roadkill in the diatribes against healthcare and welfare and educational systems and the whole deconstruction of democracy that's taking place, that the next president of Planned Parenthood needs to be an expert in understanding the threat to our democracy, that the failure to respond to them in the arena of reproductive politics could offer. And so that's the second strategic reason. Those two alone were strong enough requirements, necessities for skills and political experience that I think the next Planned Parenthood president needs in order to be atop of this particular historical moment that we're in.
Absolutely. Well, that's one of the things I thought was so powerful about it. I think sometimes we lose sight, those of us who are part of this broader left, of the importance of having people in decision-making positions within our organizations and our coalitions and even, let's say, political parties, putting aside the lack of progressivism, which so often animates the Democratic Party, but just looking at them as, you know, the ostensibly progressive of the two major parties, if they don't understand it, if the nonprofit world, if they don't understand the importance of having folks from the multiply marginalized identities of color and class and gender and sexuality and all of those things in positions of authority, then I think so much of these strategic issues that and movement building issues just get overlooked, even when the white person, let's say, who's in a position of authority, or the upper middle class and affluent person who's in a position of authority, or the straight and cisgender person, even when their intentions are great and their knowledge is fantastic, there's just a different lived experience that I think sometimes folks don't have, and that we need to be cognizant of. Yes,
I think that we need to have balance. We created, as feminists, the valuation of lived experience to knowledge production because we were fighting up against a white male belief that you have to be objective. You can't have that lived experience. As a matter of fact, lived experience contaminates your ability to make judgment and to have logic and all of that stuff. So that's what we were fighting up against. And so we swung the pendulum so far into valorizing lived experience that some people hearing us think lived experience is all that you need to know. No, you actually do need to study, do research, do your homework. Lived experience amplifies and deepens all of that. And people who don't have the lived experience don't have that capacity for the depth that lived experience offers. But it's not the only thing. And I learned that early in my days running a rape crisis center when I found out that everyone who suffers sexual violence didn't end up with the appropriate political consciousness because of it.
Yeah, there's nothing about identity that automatically conveys wisdom. There's, there's not, I mean, it can help and it can supplement, and it's certainly good to have to know what your lens is and to know what your frame is, but it certainly does not convey automatic wisdom. And I think that's an important piece that folks need to remember when they're reading that article that you've written and the importance of, in your estimation, having a woman of color in that position, that it isn't about that person automatically having greater insight. It's really a strategic concern. And of course, that person still has to know their shit and obviously would in order to be in that position. Last thing real quick before I let you go, because we're just about out of time, for folks who want to get involved in this larger struggle, maybe who are not yet connected to the reproductive justice struggle and the work that you have been doing and so many great folks are doing, what are some groups that folks can get involved with or connected to? How can folks reach out to you? What are some ways for folks, particularly young people, to get involved in this movement work if they're not already?
Well, I'm easily located through my website, lorettaross.com, so I won't have to do a commercial on that. I think that there are great organizations. My former organization, Sister Song, sistersong.net, okay, is a wonderful place to go if you want to get on the front line of not only the reproductive justice struggle, but on the Black Lives Matter movement and all the ways that we are bringing this conversation into communities of color, in particular about the importance of reproductive politics in determining community destinies. And so that's a great organization for monitoring the right. I do a lot of work with Political Research Associates up in Boston, and of course the Institute for Human Rights and Education and Research that Leonard Zeskin runs. I think that's a good organization to support and get involved with. But mainly what I ask people to do is to realize something that, of course, Elie Wiesel said a long time ago. We're at this moment where we may not be able to prevent injustices, but we should never be at a moment we fail to protest them. Mm. And so wherever you get involved, at whatever level you get involved, I'm not going to offer a judgment on whether you're doing enough or the right thing. Right. I'll only offer a judgment if you're choosing to do nothing.
Right. Right. Well, it takes everyone doing something. And I think that's a great place to end, because so often people do sort of, I think we sometimes, those of us who are activists or advocates, sometimes we judge ourselves for not doing enough. And then what we end up doing is we try to do so much, right, that we actually become less healthy for it. We don't take care of ourselves. We don't get rest. We don't eat right. We don't sleep. I'm as guilty of this as anyone, because you just feel like, oh, I got to be doing something all the time. But, you know, if you're no use to the struggle if you're dead, and you're no use to the struggle if you're not healthy enough to engage. And
Tim, you're suffering from the same thing we suffered from in the feminist movement. We didn't get the memo on self-care. It's a mind, body, soul kind of thing. You know that. Yeah, I got the memo late too. I'm not good at self-care. But at the same time, I really appreciate that the younger people behind me have understood that their job isn't to martyr themselves for the movement. Their job is to make the movement win.
And that'll do it for another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show. And look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time. And the